for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The price of a barrel of oil is, on any given day, a known fact. But the true cost of oil is not widely appreciated. In a new book, investigative journalist Peter Maas describes how, in most countries with large oil reserves, a select few become enormously wealthy, while poverty, political corruption, and environmental degradation afflict the population as a whole. His new book is titled Crude World, The Violent Twilight of Oil. Peter Maas joins me in the studio to talk about the destructive power of oil. I'll look forward to hearing your questions, comments. 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Don't forget, you can reach us through Facebook and Twitter. Good morning to you, Peter. Good to see you.
Good morning, Diane.
I'm interested that the subtitle of this is The Violent Twilight of Oil. What do you mean?
Well, what I mean is that the first commercial oil well was found in the United States 150 years ago. And oil kind of became the dominant energy force in the world economy just before World War I. And now, even if you kind of take as a guideline what the oil companies say about how much oil is left, they say
In the world.
They say that within, and their estimates are incredibly optimistic, that like for the next 20 years or whatever, we'll be able to keep on increasing the amount of oil that comes out of the ground. But 20 years compared to 150 is pretty much towards the end. And in fact, the oil companies, a lot of people think they're not being entirely honest with these numbers, and that in fact we are at the peak. So we are, if we're not at the peak, we're close to it. And given the whole kind of stretch of history, we're really kind of reaching the end where oil, there's going to be enough oil for our main energy needs. And then, you know, in terms of the violence, well, you know, there have always been wars that are about oil in whole or in part. That continues, of course. There's also other kinds of violence. There's environmental violence. There's human rights violence. There's the violence of corruption and theft, wherein money gets stolen, oil money gets stolen, and so hospitals don't get built, roads don't get built, schools don't get built. And as a result of all of that, people have lower life expectancies and they die.
I can certainly remember at the start of the Iraq War when a great many people kept saying over and over and over again, it's all about oil.
That's one of the reasons that I decided to do this book, because, I mean, I've been covering kind of world events for like the last 25 years, I'm afraid to say. And in so many places that I've been to where there is oil and even where there's not oil, people were saying it's all about oil. It's because we have oil that we're being invaded or whatever. Or if only we had oil, people would care about us. And so I really wanted to go out into the world and find out, okay, how much of this is true? And so one of the many countries I went to was Iraq. And I was there when the Marines arrived in Baghdad. I followed them to Baghdad. And I went to the Ministry of Oil a couple days after the statue of Saddam Hussein was taken down. And the ministry famously was surrounded and protected by American soldiers. And there were technocrats, Iraqis, who were outside trying to get in. And I kind of mingled with them and talked with them. And they were literally kind of like grabbing my sleeve and saying to me, it's all about oil. Huh. Look, the American troops are here. They're only protecting the Ministry of Oil. And that was visually true. That was accurate. But actually, even when something is about oil, it doesn't mean that it's only about oil. And so that was one of the kind of, you know, issues and questions that I tried to sift through as I reported this book.
But the people involved that it seems to me we ought to be caring about most of all. You talk about the poverty that's created within the population at large, while with oil, there are always populations, small populations, becoming extraordinarily wealthy.
It varies from country to country. You know, there's some countries like, let's say, Kuwait, which just has so much oil and so few people that basically it's impossible for anybody to be poor. And there are other countries like Norway, which have just has done a fantastic job of handling its oil wealth. So politically and economically, nothing's been disturbed. Everything has, in fact, been helped by it. But there are a lot of countries where, in fact, oil has played a really troubling role. And one of them, kind of the poster child for all of the bad things that oil can do, is Nigeria. And that's one of the countries that I went to. Nigeria has about 40 billion barrels of oil. Its oil is particularly prized because it's very light and easy to refine. And the country has earned something like $400 billion from it over the last 30 years. But the amazing thing is that according to the World Bank, which has done studies about this, about 80% of the revenue went to 1% of the people. And, you know, in Nigeria, you have, you know, child mortality rates, which are just extraordinary. You have really two kinds of wars going on there. You have kind of incredible levels of urban violence. Then you have in the Niger Delta, which is where most of the oil comes from, a kind of undeclared war going on between the government and militias and even between the militias. And so I went there to kind of see what that was like and why it was really happening.
1% of the population benefits from this extraordinary wealth of oil.
One of the Nigerian dictators, Sani Abacha, after he died, this was about a decade ago, he was found to have $3 billion in personal wealth stored away. This is one of the problems, is that this oil money comes in, and we know the amounts of it are large, but it's all very secretive because the contracts aren't published between the extractive companies and the governments, and then the governments don't publish what they receive, the governments don't publish where it goes. And this offers an extraordinary opportunity for people who are in a position to take money, to actually do so. There's incentive to do so. Why not? The money's there. The government's got it. Nobody's watching it. Nobody knows how much is there. Take it. And so you have, as a result of this, all this money coming in, people kind of at the ground level expect to get some. They don't. And then there's a lot of dissension as a result. So you have, as is the case in Nigeria, as is the case in other countries, a lot of civil turbulence that can break out into low-level warfare.
But give me the contrast then between how this is allowed to happen in Nigeria and what happens in Kuwait.
Well, Kuwait is incredibly lucky because it has so much oil. I mean, 90 billion barrels, and it's got about, what is it, 1 million or 2 million people. So, you know, the royal family in Kuwait can have, you know,
as much
pathways
as
that are covered in gold. And still, there's going to be enough money to provide housing and education and things of that sort for its people. But in a country like Nigeria, which has actually a very large population, about 140 million people, and though it has a lot of oil, 40 billion barrels is nothing to, you know, shake a stick at. Nonetheless, on kind of a per capita basis, it's not so much that you can just kind of like at the top steal what you want and still have a lot left over for other people. You actually have to use it well if you don't have a lot on a per capita basis in order to have a real positive effect. And that's what a country like Nigeria, unfortunately, has failed to do.
Peter Maas, his new book is titled Crude World, The Violent Twilight of Oil. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also reach us through Facebook, and you can send us a tweet. You know, you think about other resources that the world has, diamonds, for example, and the hideous nature of the treatment of individuals who've gone in for those diamonds, and yet the extraordinary wealth, again, created for a very small population. How do you compare the two?
Well, you know, the problem is in some ways that the people and the companies that are involved in extraction, unless they're made to care, unless they're made to follow the rules, unless they're made to follow moral norms, they're probably not going to do it because it's not in their self-interest, if self-interest is defined as profit and loss. And so, you know, for example, I went to Ecuador, and from the 1970s until the early 1990s, Texaco was the main extractor of oil in this Amazonian region of Ecuador. And they did just a terrible job of it because the government was very weak. They didn't know anything about oil when it was discovered, so basically handed over the keys to Texaco. And there's an enormous amount of pollution that occurred. And the people who were living there, the indigenous people, were just kind of, you know, devastated by it. The people who kind of came in to work in the oil industry have just kind of been living in miserable circumstances surrounded by pollution. You know, and as a result, and this is maybe slightly, a useful kind of denouement in a sense. There's a huge lawsuit against Chevron, which acquired Texaco a few years ago, that's about to reach the judgment phase, and it could be a very large and a multi-billion dollars judgment against Chevron for what happened. But that kind of behavior, although I think there's a little bit less of it now because there's a lot more eyes out watching for this kind of stuff, not enough eyes, not enough laws yet, but that kind of behavior was quite widespread, and it's only now, I think, in many ways, beginning to be dealt with, acknowledged, and, you know, resolved in the sense of trying to prevent it in the future and perhaps atone for what happened in the past.
You know, we were talking in the last hour about the development of natural gas and the extent to which natural gas is present in this country. New techniques are allowing the extraction. And yet, there don't seem to be quite enough people paying attention there yet either.
Well, it's one of the strange consequences of kind of the victories of the environmental movement in the United States that in many ways we in America are very insulated from some of the great damages that oil extraction or natural gas extraction can take. I mean, there's no new drilling allowed off the coast of Florida or off the coast of California, et cetera. There are very strict environmental laws in the United States, not always followed. They're quite good, but they insulate us in many ways from these problems that do exist, even in the best of circumstances, when companies are trying to follow the laws and trying to do things as well as possible. But when, you know, we don't allow drilling in our land and we kind of push it overseas to places like Nigeria and Ecuador, it's out of sight.
Peter Moss, Crude World is the title of his book, The Violent Twilight of Oil. Do join us. I look forward to hearing from you. And here's our first email for Peter Moss on his new book, which he subtitles The Violent Twilight of Oil. The book is called Crude World. Susan in East Windsor, New Jersey writes, I've thought for years the true cost of the energy from oil has never been shared with anyone. If we had been paying for that during the 150 years of oil usage, we would have a lot left over. We would also have alternate energies, as the cost would be more equal. The previous discussion on gas fracturing is a continuation of this same mindset.
We have had a tendency, and it's been kind of a luxury, to outsource a lot of the problems of our energy consumption. We outsource them in the sense of like, okay, for quite a long time, we didn't care about the carbon emissions. And so a lot of carbon built up in the atmosphere. Well, that's a cost of oil that we weren't paying that actually we're beginning to become aware of and perhaps do something about and take on the burden ourselves. there are these other costs of environmental pollution to the land. There are costs in terms of like people fighting over oil. And again, although we have been involved in some wars for oil, I mean, what happened in the Persian Gulf War in 1990-91 certainly was. And so we were involved and there was a cost in terms of our own blood in that. Much more so more recently in Iraq. Still, those are episodic in a way. And most of the time, we aren't aware, indeed, of what these costs are. And they're costs in money, other people's money. They're costs in blood, other people's blood. They're costs in lives lost. And I think that now there's beginning to be a recognition. There are some really good NGOs, and there's some good information getting out there. An organization, it's called Publish What You Pay, which is very aggressive behind the idea of trying to get all the numbers out there in terms of what companies pay, what governments receive, et cetera. And then I think also the enablement of a lot of people through new media, et cetera. I mean, you can find out very quickly what's happening in Nigeria. You can find out much more easily than used to be the case, kind of a little bit of what's happening in Saudi Arabia.
You tried to find out what had happened in Equatorial Guinea in West Africa. What happened there?
Well, this is a fantastic story in all the wrong ways, unfortunately. Equatorial Guinea is a really small country in West Africa, population about 600,000. And in the 1990s, it found oil in its waters in the Gulf of Guinea, actually a fair amount of oil, particularly for a country that small. And so it began exporting it. Exxon and Marathon were the major American companies involved over there. But quite surprisingly, in those first years, all the money, and this was hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars that were being paid to the government of Equatorial Guinea for the oil, were not showing up in that country really at all. And then it emerged, partly as a result of investigations here by journalists and by Senate investigators, that all this money that had been going into the coffers of the government, or was supposed to be going into the coffers of the government of Equatorial Guinea, was going into bank accounts controlled personally by the dictator of Equatorial Guinea, Teodoro Obiang. And this is kind of an interesting local angle. These accounts were at Riggs Bank in Washington, D.C., and this is hundreds of millions of dollars that were basically in these secret accounts. There were suitcases of cash, like $1 million of cash, that were being dragged from the embassy of Equatorial Guinea here in Washington, D.C., to the Riggs Bank branch by one of the Riggs Bank employees without any kind of suspicious activity reports being filed to the government, as is required when somebody deposits $1.5 million in cash.
10,000 and more requires some reporting.
Exactly. Well, the money was, there's just so much money to be made in handling money that way.
I see.
That Riggs Bank, the officials there, were more than happy to do that. And I would imagine that other bankers would have been happy to do that. Eventually, it did catch up with them. I went to Equatorial Guinea a couple of years ago to kind of look a little bit more deeply into this. And I lasted about, I think it was 9 days in the country before the information minister summoned me and said I was a spy and that I was being expelled.
A spy?
Well, the problem was that Equatorial Guinea is one of the most kind of dictatorial countries around. I mean, the last election a year ago, the ruling party won 98% of the vote. Most journalists who have managed to get there, at least in the era that was most acute, a lot of them got kicked out. It's a very paranoid regime. The human rights record is just absolutely terrible. And so as a result, when you're a journalist and you're asking a lot of questions, et cetera, after a while, governments in situations like that become displeased. So the information minister taken to the airport, and then he started rummaging through my bags and started accusing me again of being a spy, saying he was going to be taking me downtown for questioning, which in a country like that, you really don't want to have happen. But because Equatorial Guinea exports most of its resources to American consumers, and the companies that do it are American, I kind of pulled a Trump card when this was happening. And I said to the minister, who was just furious, hey, listen, if you keep doing this, if you keep, you know, trying to slap me around, if you're going to take me downtown, your president is never going to go to America ever again, and you're going to be in big trouble. Now, on my part, this was a total bluff because, of course, I had no idea would the American government actually care about an American journalist, me. I had no idea. But it was enough of a kind of problem for the minister. He realized, like, oh, no, we don't want to piss off America, that he then kind of stopped and let me go.
Was there any contact on your part with American officials in New Guinea?
Yeah, well, I had when I arrived in the country, there was only one American diplomat there at the time, and I had had lunch with her when everything was going fine. And then when the information minister summoned me and told me I was being expelled, kind of the first thing I did, I had 15 minutes to pack my bags, was call up this diplomat and say, I'm being expelled. I'm packing my bags right now. They're taking me to the airport. And she said, okay, I'll come to the airport. And she came to the airport and, you know, kind of let it be known that she was there, and then she left, and then the minister came, and all this stuff happened.
I see.
But
I see.
I was at least aware that it was known to others, the American government, that this problem was happening, and if they had taken me downtown for interrogation, the government would have known about it, and that doesn't really kind of prevent, however, bad things from potentially happening, because governments do stupid things all the time, and the Equatorial Guinean government could have done that.
What about Russia? How does the Russian oil story figure in here?
Well, this is a fantastic story. I went there for this book, and I hung out with one of the oil billionaires of Russia, the president and largest shareholder of Lukoil. His name is Vagid Alekperov. And oil and power are so intricately linked in Russia and were in the Soviet Union that you can't really separate them. So in his office, and this is the chairman of this oil company, which actually is not owned by the government, one of the few in Russia that isn't owned by the government. But nonetheless, on his desk, instead of seeing a picture of his wife, of his daughter, it was a picture of Vladimir Putin, the leader of Russia. And when I asked him, Alekperov, the head of the oil company, you know, what do you think of Putin? He just said, I respect him very much, and I listen to him very closely. And this, to me, was one of the demonstrations of kind of how intricately linked these two things are, and how, in many ways, it's not a positive thing, because governments can be too strong. And when you combine the usual levers of government power with all of the money that comes in as a result of oil, you can end up with a situation where the government becomes autocratic, where the government also doesn't see beyond oil and try to develop a diversified economy. It doesn't see the need for democracy and civic institutions, etc. And I think that's part of the problem in Russia today, is that it is so focused on oil, the government is so concentrated sitting on top of it, that it doesn't kind of feel the need or have pressure on it to actually become more of a diversified government, in the sense of trying to push economic development in other regions and also trying to push democracy out.
How much oil does Russia have?
Russia, before it was the Soviet Union, actually, and this people don't really kind of understand this as well, Soviet Union actually pulled more oil out of the ground on a daily basis than Saudi Arabia did. And Russia today is still kind of one of the largest oil exporters in the world. It has, you know, enough oil to last it and its clients for quite a long time. So there's really no question kind of about, you know, Russia's dominance there. But the one interesting thing, and this is where oil becomes a trap for the governments that have it, they're addicted to it as well, is that, and Russian officials have said this, Alekperov has mentioned this, that Russia probably can't increase the amount of oil it pulls out of the ground, and it's going to kind of start declining. So these countries and these governments that do rely on it, that kind of are addicted to it in an opposite way from us. We're addicted to it. We need the oil, and we have to pay for it. They need the oil because they need the money that they get from it. When the money stops coming in those huge amounts, then what are they left with?
But how is the Russian population benefited from the oil?
You know, there are benefits and there are drawbacks. I mean, Russia today, financially, in terms of per capita income, as a result of the increase in oil prices and as a result of kind of a return of oil production to Russia after the fall of the Soviet Union, per capita income is higher than it had been before. It's not spread evenly. So in a short-term sense, many Russians are living better now than they did before. And that's a good thing, because Russia certainly needs that. And the country was in terrible, terrible shape after the fall of the Soviet Union. But, you know, the problem is that it's kind of a trap door, in that how long is this money going to keep coming in? Is it going to keep coming in the ways that it has been? And that's unlikely. And it was particularly important in terms of Russia, because the Soviet Union, there are lots of reasons for its collapse in 1992. But one of the interesting reasons, that when it was having the huge economic problems in the 1980s, which is kind of what really broke the back of the Soviet Union, Yegor Gaidar, who's a prominent Soviet Russian economist who was part of the kind of reform effort in the early 90s, he and others are now saying that the real thing that broke the camel's back in the Soviet Union was oil. The price of oil collapsed in the mid-1980s, at the same time actually as the Soviet Union was having trouble producing oil. And that just took so much money out of the Soviet system that it could no longer survive.
Now, how do you compare what happened in Russia to what's going on now in Venezuela?
Well, Venezuela is, to my mind, is a really kind of a tragedy in the making for strange reasons. I went there and I watched Hugo Chavez's radio and television program that he does weekly, which went on, in the case that I watched it, for about 6 hours. I mean, Oprah and Bill Clinton have nothing on this man. And I went to a press conference that he gave, and he was, you know, as gregarious and flamboyant as ever. And on the one hand, it really is necessary for countries to try to do something different to make their resources really work for the people. And when Chavez came to power, he said, look, I'm going to make oil work for the people. The phrase that he used was sowing the oil, really kind of like, instead of just having a great oil company that makes a lot of money and having foreign oil companies that make money off of it, trying to push the money to the people and provide them with services. And he has done more than previous governments have done. But he also has a very strong political program associated with that. And so a lot of the economic programs he has, I find are somewhat unsustainable. I went to one of the cooperatives that he's developed with oil money, and it was a wonderful cooperative. People were very happy. They were working 6 hours a day, and they were making shoes that really weren't very good at all. And it reminded me very much of visiting Yugoslavia back in when did I first visit it? Oh, my gosh, I think in the early 1980s. And they had these wonderful cooperatives, and the workers were very happy. But it wasn't sustainable. It was being sustained by loans from the world community. This is Yugoslavia I'm talking about now. And when those loans stopped, Yugoslavia began falling apart. And the same situation perhaps will present itself with Yugoslavia. I mean, sorry, with Venezuela.
Venezuela.
When oil prices, if they decline, they decline. Or if, as is inevitable, oil production declines, what's going to be left? You know, these cooperatives, what's going to happen to them?
Peter Moss, his new book is titled Crude World, The Violent Twilight of Oil. At 27 before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And we'll open the phones now, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. First to Baltimore, Maryland. Michael, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning, Diana. It's nice talking to you. I'm a first-time caller, and I find the topic you are discussing very interesting. I'm originally from Nigeria, and a question keeps coming to my mind is that, how come this corruption keeps going on? This oil that is supposed to benefit the people are becoming a cause for all these countries. And the reason, I think, is because the world body needs to come together and have a monitoring body that, I mean, find out where are all this money going into? Who are these thieves and the looters? In most cases, I think this money ends up in Swiss banks, Western banks, and American banks. And until there is a stop to that practice, we are never going to have these people benefiting from the oil money.
Michael, I think you have a first-rate point there, Peter.
This is where actually the story turns around in the sense of not being so depressing, because in terms of like monitoring bodies, et cetera, I think there are things that are happening. There's a government-led initiative which has this, you know, terribly boring name because it was invented by technocrats, called the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative, which a lot of Western governments have begun. The United Nations, the World Bank supports it, and they're signing up these countries that have oil and other resources to begin to kind of like have voluntary codes for disclosures of money. There's also, over here, there's a bill that's being introduced in the Senate by Chuck Schumer, by Ben Cardin, or who are co-sponsors of it, as well as Dick Lugar, which is going to require every company that is registered with the SEC and that is involved in an extractive industry, not just oil, but also mining, to publish.
Gas.
And gas, exactly.
And gas.
And silver and gold, et cetera.
Right.
Every company that is registered with the SEC that's involved with those kinds of industries will have to publish any payment it makes to countries with resources that are above $100,000. So that means that all of the money, basically, that goes from American companies, and not just American companies because it's ones that are registered with the SEC and a lot of foreign companies are registered with the SEC, all of the money that goes over there is going to be declared if a bill like this passes. And there are other initiatives to do similar things like that.
Is there a loophole there that if it's below $100,000, you can slip through.
There's that. That's a loophole, but it's, you know, better to have some sort of program with loopholes than no program at all. And of course, you know, there are many ways around laws of this sort. I mean, it's a bit like kind of a sports and doping. You know, sports bodies have new laws about what drugs can be used, and they have new kind of ways to find it. But then athletes and the scientists behind them find new ways around it.
Yeah.
So it's a constant game. But these things are happening, and in the countries themselves. I mean, Nigeria is an interesting example. There are now kind of civic institutions that are developing, that are becoming stronger, that are demanding accountability. There are occasionally kind of people in the government who emerge as corruption czars or whatever, who actually have some power and do what they can.
But will that also mean oversight of the activities themselves, not just the transfer of money?
That's kind of a separate issue in the sense of the what people are focusing on now, and I think it's important to have a focus, is indeed the money. Following the money, making sure that the money is kind of out in the open and is not being stolen or wasted.
Peter Moss, his book Crude World is all about what he calls the violent twilight of oil. Short break, and when we come back, more of your calls. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary on the web at healthreform.org. And by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with journalist David Weigel about the remaking of the right. He's written about the Tea Party protests, the 9/12 March on Washington, the Values Voter Summit, and Glenn Beck for the web magazine The Washington Independent. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And back to the phones now for your questions for Peter Moss, all about oil, what's happening around the world, and how he views the violent twilight of oil. Let's go to Asheville, North Carolina. Good morning, James. You're on the air.
Good morning. I just wanted to comment and get a comment from your guest. Not only America could use, but the world, is hemp seed oil. It replenishes the soil each harvest. It is an early American cash crop. You know, it burns clean. It's the first Model T Ford ran on hemp seed oil. George Washington, Thomas Jefferson both grew hemp seed.
All right. Do you want to comment, Peter?
I don't know so much about hemp seed itself, but I think the caller gets to a point, which is that, I mean, there are a lot of possibilities out there. You know, one of the things I've tried to do in this book is portray these kind of human problems that oil has created in some of the countries that provide it to us. And I hope that if we recognize that, you know, geez, there's a real problem out there in these countries that our need for oil is created, that then we'll realize, like, okay, in addition to the problem of global warming, there is this other problem we really do need as quickly as possible to get off oil. And to get off oil, not entirely, that's not going to happen for, you know, quite a long time, but to reduce our need for it, we have to turn to alternatives, and they're there. And hemp seed oil may be one of the alternatives. But, you know, this program just an hour before I was on was talking about natural gas. There are all kinds of other alternatives in the sense of, obviously, people talk about solar energy, wind energy, et cetera.
Yeah.
You know, people talk about nuclear energy. People talk about, you know, particularly conservation is incredibly important. Efficiency is incredibly important. Adjusting in the developed world lifestyle so that we don't drive as much, maybe so that we don't eat as much meat, maybe that we grow more of our food closer to home. All of these things, there are just so many things that can be done that would reduce our reliance on oil, that would perhaps make, you know, us pay less support and money to dictators that have it, that would make us less likely to fight wars on behalf of it. And we've got to go in all these directions.
And one of the countries we have not talked about yet is Saudi Arabia. What happens there?
Well, you know, Saudi Arabia is a fascinating case because it could have. Ordinary people in Saudi Arabia are not poor. They're not as rich as they could or should be, given the amount of oil the country has. It has 260 billion barrels of oil, which is more than twice as much as a runner-up. But they're not poor. Politically, the country is virtually feudal in terms of the power of the royal family, but it was never going to be a kind of Jeffersonian democracy. But the big problem of oil, as far as Saudi Arabia is concerned, particularly for us, and this has, you know, been discussed quite a bit, is that the oil revenues have gone over the last 20 years to fund a lot of the Islamic extremist organizations, and that have kind of spread those ideas. And of course, you know, as we also know, 11 of the 15 hijackers on 9/11 were Saudi. So the problem of oil in terms of Saudi Arabia is that, you know, it has, the money has been used to fund a movement that has really not done so.
But
such
are
great
you
things.
Saying that among the young in Saudi Arabia, there's this social dissatisfaction that leads to the development of this kind of thinking?
I worked in Iraq for a number of months, and I was in the town of Samarra, which is in the Sunni Triangle, and this was in 2005. And I was reporting on kind of Iraqi and American forces working together, and the forces that I were with had captured a Saudi youth, 20 years old, who had come as a jihadi to wage war against Americans. And I was offered the opportunity to talk with him. He was a prisoner. And I accepted. And I went and talked to him, and he was in this terrible detention center. I could hear prisoners screaming. It was not a nice place. And I asked him, why are you here? What made you come here?
Yeah.
And he was 20 years old. He was from Dahran, which is the oil region of Saudi Arabia. And his story was a typical one of many Saudis. He said, look, you know, I went to college, but it really wasn't very interesting, and I knew I wouldn't have a job when I graduated because, parenthetically, Saudi Arabia has an unemployment problem. Oil doesn't create jobs. The oil industry is capital, but not labor-intensive. So he wasn't going to have a job. He wasn't in love with the royal family or the government. Not a lot of people there are because, you know, they take a lot of money for themselves. And in the meantime, there was all this Islamic extremist ideology that was floating around, and that you know, basically kind of gave him the idea that the most glorious thing that he could do with his life is go to Iraq and maybe become a martyr in
How
the fight against America.
How typical do you think he was?
Well, you know, the majority of Saudi youth are not going to Iraq or to other places to fight against Americans or infidels or you know, even against other sects in the Muslim faith. So I wouldn't say he's typical in the sense of, like, that's what most Saudi youth are doing.
Yeah.
But the problem is that enough Saudi youth and enough youth in other countries are tempted in this way that it becomes a problem, not just for us, but even for these societies, because Saudi Arabia itself was hit with terrorism that was directed at the royal family.
All right, to Plantation, Florida. Good morning, Chris. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I'm glad to hear you're back.
Thank
How are you?
Fine, thanks.
Great. I'm a volunteer member of the Pickens Plan. I just wondering if you or Peter had done much research into natural gas or compressed natural gas, especially since the United States has so much of it as an alternative.
Now, Chris, did you miss our last hour, which was totally focused on natural gas?
Yes, I did.
Okay, then go online and listen to that program, which I think will answer a good many of your questions.
All right. Thank you very much,
Dan. All right. Thanks for calling to John in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Hi. Enjoy your show.
Thank you.
Yes, and good luck with the medical, whatever.
Thanks.
It is, yeah. I just wanted to ask if your guest had, in his work on his book, had thought about extractive units and the impact that has on the political extractive industries and the impact on the political unit involved. And I also wondered if he had considered what the conditions of the political unit were before the discovery of oil as a way of predicting what the situation would be after some years of extraction of the oil. And I'll just take my answer off.
Thanks
off
for
the,
calling,
radio.
John.
Thank you.
Okay.
Sure.
Bye-bye.
Well, that's a great question because it involves kind of, you know, hypothetical thinking. Well, what would have happened in Nigeria, for example, just to take one country, if they hadn't discovered oil? What we know is that Nigeria, at the time of its independence in the early 1960s and before it had discovered large amounts of commercially viable oil, we know that it was a fairly stable country that had a vigorous agricultural sector and also had kind of nascent industries, et cetera, and that its future could have been good. Now, it had a lot of kind of inherent problems. It was one of these kind of, you know, artificially 20th century drawn by colonial map maker type countries with a heck of a lot of ethnic groups and different religious groups too. So it was never going to have an easy time. The problem is that it's not so much chicken and egg in terms of which came first, oil or inherent cultural or political problems, but it's kind of chicken and egg in that you have inherent problems and oil can accentuate those. And so that's kind of, in a sense, what happens, not in all countries, but in some countries. And, you know, we've been talking a lot about Nigeria because it is kind of a poster child for these sorts of things. But, you know, we could also talk about, you know, more recent producers of oil. We could talk about Chad and what effect oil's had there, which is not good. We could talk about it in Sudan. Also, it doesn't appear to be good. Mm. And the list kind of goes on.
And here's an email from Michael in Dallas, who says, coming from South Africa, living now in the U.S., I firmly believe South Africa's been similarly cursed with gold and minerals. All resource-based economies fall prey to corruption and environmental degradation. Massive profits to a few, while whichever government is in power, corrupted by these corporations. Common people are fed a diet of false promises and veneer of hope by these industries. I'm not implying the divide between black and white. Most of the wealth leaves the country and is controlled by foreign corporations, leaving all South Africans in a stressed state.
Extractive industries are brutal industries almost kind of by definition. I mean, they gouge the earth. And there's a lot of damage that's caused, and it's also a terribly difficult industry to work in, even under the best of circumstances. So I don't think that, you know, we've got to be realistic here, that these are never going to be kind of white-collar jobs in the sense of safety, et cetera. But what we do need to be kind of demanding is that, given the difficulty that these industries present to the environment and to their own workers, that absolutely every care needs to be taken to limit the damages.
But as you went about writing this book, you also talked to a number of U.S. oil executives. What was their perspective?
Well, they were great, actually, in the sense of they're very colorful individuals. And there was, you know, there was one I talked to who actually had been indicted and pled guilty to tax evasion for money that he received from a deal. And I met him after he had just been released from prison and was living in a halfway house. And you know, he said to me, look, you know, it's like if you don't want these problems, if you don't like this industry and where it goes and what it does where it goes, then fine. You know, if you only want us to drill for oil in London and Paris, we'll do that. But then, you know, you're going to be stepping over manure in the streets of New York because you're going to be riding around on carriages. So, you know, the oil people that I met, privately, they admit to a lot of the problems that publicly they and their companies will not, that there is corruption, that the incentives for corruption are inherent, that environmentally not enough is done, that rules are abided by only when they're forced to. But, you know, they do point out that unless we want to kind of like, you know, drill only in nice countries, it is going to be difficult. Mm. But we can't accept difficulty as meaning that we surrender to the difficulties.
But, you know, if the demand for oil begins to come down, how could that affect the countries so deeply involved right now?
You know, I always shy away from hard predictions because I think that, you know, in the long term, if these countries can reset their priorities so that instead of just relying on oil and having oil cause the problems that it does, they can begin to have other industries and to kind of like wash the oil and corruption and out of their systems. That's good. In the short term, it could be destabilizing because, you know, there's less money, so maybe people fight even harder over it.
And but the poorer people suffer more.
You know, in the Niger Delta, it was really interesting talking to people there. I mean, I stayed in a village right across from a big natural gas facility, and they were living in terrible circumstances. No water, no electricity, no schools, no nothing. And, you know, they were living under the shadow in the evenings of this massive flare from this oil facility. But they didn't want it shut down. They didn't want the oil or the natural gas industry to go away. They just wanted the benefits from it. So, you know, you don't want to say, like, you know, if the price goes down or if there's no more money going over there, that's going to solve problems, because that can, in a short term, make things worse.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And let's go now to Dowagiac, Michigan. Good morning, Herbert.
Hello.
Hi there.
My comment is the fact that our U.S. dollars, as the U.S. is the largest consumer of crude oil, is what has fueled this whole thing. And it seems a tragedy that we, with all this natural gas, using it as a bridge until we can get more power through atomic and maybe clean coal, the government seems to be doing nothing to really encourage it. The natural gas is available. It's cheap. It would be easy to put stations around for it, and that nobody seems to be doing anything.
And Herbert, I would also refer you to our last hour. If you're online, you can listen to it by virtue of clicking on the Diane Rehm Show and going to our last hour, which was totally focused on natural gas. All this points to alternative forms of energy.
I think, you know, the positive thing in this story is that we shouldn't be waiting around for, like, you know, manna from heaven, like, oh, there's going to be some secret that's going to be revealed or some new discovery or whatever. We don't even need that. The doors are open in front of us. And I think there are a lot of doors. There are doors for conservation, efficiency, natural gas, hemp seed oil, you know, vegetarianism. I mean, you can go all around the block with all these things. It's painful to go through any one, if not many, of these doors at the same time, but they're open. They're there. We just have to kind of move forward through them.
All right, Tan, one last call. Let's go to Abraham. He's in St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you for taking my call.
Surely.
Yes, as a regular listener to your show, I enjoyed quite a lot.
Good. We're almost out of time, Abraham, okay. So a quick question, please.
Well, my question is, since we are moving towards green energy and the politicians, government know what the problem is in this third world country, is there anything that we can do, you know, as a government in America to help and change the behavior, you know, of these politicians in these third or second world countries where we get this oil from?
Good question.
I think it's primarily up to the people who live in those countries to kind of take matters in their own hands, and they're doing that. I mean, there are groups that are organizing there. It's very possible for American citizens individually or for the government to give support to these organizations. I mean, you know, there's Zero Corruption is an organization in Nigeria. There are many anti-corruption organizations in all these countries that are available for support from American citizens. But again, I think part of it is these people actually taking matters in their own hands, and I think they're beginning to in many countries.
And, you know, even in this country, you've got that not my backyard effect, especially where windmills are concerned. It's a transition period, clearly. And I think your book is going to add a great deal to the conversation. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Diane, very much.
Peter Moss. His book is titled Crude World, The Violent Twilight of Oil. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.